Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, Gary Bass tells us about the surprising turn five one-time nuclear hawks have made.
These guys got a shock after September 11th, and then in 2007, they come out with an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that nuclear weapons are something that we need to get rid of.
Louisa Thomas discusses the remarkable career of Rosemont Bernier.
She had a way of bringing some of these remote and larger-than-life people to life.
And Gregory Coles has bestseller news. Well, the dreams of a post-nuclear age have not come about. It's always, it seems, going to be a nuclear age. There's a new book called The Partnership, Five Cold Warriors and Their Quest to Ban the Bomb. It's by Philip Taubman, who is a longtime distinguished correspondent at the Times, but no longer. He retired. And it's reviewed for us by a distinguished historian, Gary Bass, who's here to talk about it. Welcome, Gary.
Hi, Sam.
So who are these Five Cold Warriors? And it's actually surprising to hear the name, so you should tell us who they were.
Yeah, they are not the likeliest people to decide that nuclear bombs are a terrible thing. It's Henry Kissinger, George Shultz, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, and somebody who many readers won't have heard of, who's a physicist named Sid Drell.
And when did this happen? Is this kind of a small movement among the elect? What was going on with these guys?
These guys got a shock after September 11th, and then in 2007, they come out with an op-ed piece in the Wall Street Journal saying that nuclear weapons are something that we need to get rid of.
They all signed on to it?
They all signed on to it, and Taubman goes into a lot of detail about the negotiations among them of how they're going to sign off on this collective piece. But they've all decided that this sort of prime instrument of American power, nuclear weapons, is something that is now outdated and something that the United States needs to get rid of.
Well, let's start with the figure who was probably best known, Henry Kissinger. Now, in the 1950s, if I remember, he became actually quite famous as a nuclear strategist and talked about, you know, limited nuclear war. And this was part of the talk of the time. It's not as if he was in some far part of the spectrum there. What is the process that someone like that goes through whereby he gets a kind of, you know, pacifist religion or something?
Well, I don't think Kissinger's got a pacifist religion. And in fact, Taubman is quite skeptical throughout the book that Kissinger even believes in abolition. Mm-hmm. Kissinger is in many ways the odd man out in this group. Kissinger, when he was in power, used nuclear alerts, went to DEFCON 3 in 1969 and in 1973.
And tell us what DEFCON 3 is.
Defense Condition 3, which means a heightened level of preparedness among American strategic forces, a way of scaring the Soviet Union. As you mentioned, he wrote an early book that sort of helped make his name, where he talks about the prospects for finding limited nuclear war. So the idea of him reinventing himself somehow as an abolitionist is something that's kind of weird, and Taubman really grapples with it, that Shultz and the others who seem to be much more true believers about this have a hard time throughout the book in keeping Kissinger as part of their little group.
Well, let's talk about Shultz a little bit, because here he was, powerful figure in the Reagan administration, and Reagan himself, we now understand, and maybe should have at the time known better, really did want to abolish nuclear weapons or come as close to it as he could. Where did Shultz fit in at that point?
So Shultz is among this group somebody who's the true believer of the group. He, as Reagan's Secretary of State at the Reykjavik summit in 1986, which Taubman covered as a reporter, they came, you know, remarkably close to coming up with a deal that would, within 10 years, get rid of both the U.S. and the Soviet arsenals.
So this is Gorbachev and Reagan.
Gorbachev and Reagan, and Shultz is there as, you know, attending Reagan as Secretary of State. And Shultz takes it very seriously and seems, you know, visibly disappointed by this, and it hangs over him for the rest of his
life. Disappointed that it didn't work.
That it didn't work. And he's somebody who, unlike some of these others and unlike a lot of people in the American foreign policy establishment, Shultz is an economist, and he came up through domestic policy. So he's not somebody who's sort of part of any kind of nuclear priesthood. He says, I never learned to love the bomb. Mm. So for him, it's a little bit less wrenching to say, we need to get rid of these things.
And what about Sam Nunn?
Nunn is a Democrat. They wanted to make sure that this was a bipartisan group. Nunn is a senator from Georgia.
Was enormously powerful decade or two ago in the Senate.
Absolutely. And a very, you know, particularly on foreign affairs, and seen as, you know, a conservative, centrist, kind of Southern Democrat. And none is responsible for one of the most successful anti-proliferation programs, which is a program that he did with Richard Lugar, another senator, a distinguished Republican, called Nunn-Lugar, which is an attempt to sort of lock down Soviet loose nukes, Soviet fissile material, get control over a former Soviet arsenal.
So this was after the collapse of the Soviet Empire, and there was no longer the centralized control over this massive arsenal the Soviets had. Now there's a fear that it's almost up for grabs.
Exactly. And they're worried about what's going to happen to it. They're also worried about what Soviet nuclear scientists are going to do who now can't find work in the Soviet arsenal, and they're trying to figure out where they might look for work in sort of shadowy corners of the world.
Selling their secrets and their knowledge.
Yeah, exactly. So that's something that, you know, Nunn and Lugar pushed through, and it's something that – it's a program that's still in existence.
Does a program like that work, Gary? I mean, has this one worked?
Oh, yeah. No, I think those things really do. Whether or not they work as well as they should, but it's something that is – I think for people who are put off by the utopianism of the idea of a world without nuclear weapons, the thought of a world where at least nuclear arsenals and stockpiles of fissile material are more secure, are more safeguarded against smugglers, against attempts by groups like Al-Qaeda or Aum Shinrikyo in Japan, which was also interested in nukes, attempts by these sorts of groups to get a hold of them. That's something that I think even non-utopians might say, this is a useful thing.
Okay, Gary, so now we look at the emerging nuclear threat. The one we hear about most is, of course, Iran. What would these distinguished experts and authorities have to say about that? How do we deal with a nation like Iran?
That, I think, is a much harder question. I mean, I think they want overall to be looking at a posture where you're drawing down on nuclear weapons so that in a crisis, a confrontation with Iran, that the United States would at least have some way of insulating itself against the accusation of hypocrisy, that the Iranians will say, why is it that you Americans are allowed to have nukes, but we're not? And Henry Kissinger says in this book, you know, that it's very hard for the United States to rely so heavily on nuclear weapons while telling other nations that they're not allowed to have anything to do with that. And that's something that I think actually could be a useful step.
Yeah, I mean, that actually, it's a valid argument, isn't it? That we're the country that actually used the atomic bomb, that we dropped it. So how do we make a moral argument, or don't – is it not moral and purely strategic and tactical?
Well, I think there is a strategic and tactical argument that Taubman and Kissinger and other people throw in. It's not purely moral, which is that there's kind of a leveling effect to nuclear weapons, that Pakistan can get them, North Korea can get them. So in a way, it's a cheap road to superpower status. And by de-emphasizing them, by not making nukes sort of the currency of great powerdom, then you may actually enhance American power.
And where would we say now this movement, though it almost seems too strong, where this kind of tendency among these brilliant strategic thinkers is now, how much influence are they having, say, over the Obama administration, over the Republican field of presidential contenders? Are they being listened to?
Well, Taubman argues that Obama has been very influenced by this. And at a minimum, it gives Obama cover that Obama is an abolitionist. He says that the United States should be looking towards getting rid of all nukes. And it's a lot easier for a Democratic president to say that when you can say, well, look, Henry Kissinger says that I should be doing that too.
And in fact, he's brought Kissinger to the White House partly to get some of that ideological cover, hasn't he?
Yes, he definitely has. And it all, and Taubman also, you know, suggests in the book that part of the reason why Kissinger signed on to this kind of unlikely initiative is that Kissinger likes getting invited to the White House.
Who wouldn't? Thanks a lot, Gary.
Thanks, Sam.
That's Gary Bass, who this week reviews The Partnership, Five Cold Warriors and Their Quest to Ban the Bomb by Philip Taubman. Well, as we progress further and further into the 21st century, the 20th century seems more and more remote. There's an important new memoir called Some of My Lives, a scrapbook memoir by Rosamund Bernier. It's reviewed for us by one of our favorite reviewers, Louisa Thomas, memoirist herself or biographer, who's here to talk about it. We greet her from Washington. Welcome, Louisa.
Hi, Sam.
So tell us who Rosamund Bernier was, or is.
She is. She is 95, born in 1916 in the middle of World War I. She's had a long and extraordinary life. You may not know who she is, but lots of people that you do certainly counted her as a friend. She was a friend of people like Miró and Picasso, and from her perch at Vogue, had some extraordinary interviews as well, and also as a founder of an important French art magazine, whose name I'm going to butcher because I can't speak French, but Loyal, the Eye. She has written now a memoir about her life, knowing these people, and also her life, which was a rather extraordinary life, lived around the world, from Acapulco to Paris and to New York, where she ended up as a lecturer at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, where she was known as the biggest draw in town.
Why was she so big a draw, Louisa?
She was an extraordinary storyteller, and that does come through in her memoir. She had a way of bringing some of these remote and larger-than-life people to life. She had an eye for detail. In a way, it was almost an artist's eye. One of my favorite moments was when she talked about meeting various people, and she would always just know the perfect little detail to pick out, like the blue that Matisse would wear. She always had this way of connecting with people. Frida Kahlo's love of pets was something that they bonded over. And she's very funny. And she would stand on the stage at the Met, and she would wear couture. She would, you know, she would wear Oscar de la Renta and jewels, and introduce people into this glamorous world with a kind of sense of humor, and also, you know, some clear way of describing their art.
Louisa, Rosamund Bernier is also married to a very distinguished person in the world of arts. Tell us about that relationship.
It was not her first marriage, and that's her own personal life isn't really very much a part of this story until she meets the art critic John Russell, who was a longtime critic for the New York Times. I think that their relationship began in 1970. Or certainly she moved to New York after a difficult divorce, and he followed her there from London. They had what seems certainly in the book, but also by all accounts to have been a real romance at the end of their lives, over the course of many decades, but because it had long lives. But they were certainly quite the power couple in the art world in some way. When they got married, they were married in the Glass House, a famous house of the architect Philip Johnson, and Aaron Copland, you know, walked her down the aisle, and it was very, you know, a very kind of star-studded event.
Louisa, in your review of Some of My Lives, you say Bernier wasn't an artist, she wasn't a socialite either, but she turned being social into a kind of art. And we can look back at the great period of the early 20th century in Paris in particular, or even New York, and say there were figures like this, particularly women figures. Is that something, this kind of combination of aesthetic refinement and social grace, is that something that just there's no place for in our particular moment? Or is there a kind of continuing tradition of that sort of salon hostess person?
Well, it's funny. You know, as I read her memoir, I found myself filled with a mixture of envy, awe, and skepticism, because she really did know how to give a gift or how to give a compliment or how to turn an awkward moment into one that had everyone laughing. And there is a certain kind of cunning to it. I think that now, because manners are so much more fluid, it is hard to work within the kind of accepted strictures that she grew up understanding and exploiting. You know, she knew very well what people expected. And because she knew what people expected, she knew how to both upend their expectations and fulfill them. And I think it is harder to do that now. And, you know, I think that there are pockets of society where it's a kind of salon life lives on. And I certainly think that what she was very good at, it continues to be very effective. You know, I almost found myself, as I was taking notes to write the review, taking notes about how she managed to win over truculent people, because it was there was a kind of lesson to it. I mean, I think there's also a little bit of maybe darker aspect is too strong a phrase, but there is a kind of reason that some of those, you know, some of those conventions don't exist. Certainly, a lot of them were built around the satisfaction of dealing with these enormous egos.
Louisa, will we not see this particular kind of woman again? And in the culture, is she really the creation of a period that's now gone by, that we've passed by?
She really did. Well, she spanned so much of the 20th century, and she came into contact with so much of high culture from the 20th century. It's hard to imagine someone having both the extraordinary access and the extraordinary luck that she enjoyed. But I certainly think that there are people who will continue to figure out how to tell great stories and delight people. And there's a question of, I think, anytime you come into contact with people who write memoirs about their famous friends, you know, are they a snob or why are they doing this? She had this extraordinary power to make any encounter seem delightful. I mean, there's a scene in which she's swimming with Henry Moore, interviewing him about Rodin, and then there's a scene in which she's swimming with her pet penguin. There will be people who have that kind of instinct for, you know, coming up with these moments in life that are kind of absurd and ridiculous and charming and also evocative. And so, you know, will we see someone like, you know, the great lecturer magazine writer? I don't know. I probably not. But I can't help but think that, you know, we're going to still have people who are continue to tell charming stories.
Thanks so much, Louisa.
Thank you.
That's Louisa Thomas, who reviews Some of My Lives, a scrapbook memoir by Rosamund Bernier, in this week's book review. Gregory Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hey, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Really not a lot. On the hardcover lists, there are no new books at all this week. And the one interesting new title over on the ebook side of things is this Albert Einstein essay collection, Out of My Later Years, which hits the ebook nonfiction list at number 10. This book was first published in 1950, and it's a pretty candid, revealing look at Einstein's thoughts on ethics and philosophy and world affairs. He writes about himself as a Jew and about the rise of Nazism and the nuclear age, of course, about physics and just the pleasures of a life of thinking.
Gee, I wish I knew those pleasures. Now, in your column, you write about Robert K. Massey's long-awaited biography of Catherine the Great. Still on the list?
It is. It's at number 8 in its 6th week now. One of the things that really comes through in Massey's biography is what an avid reader Catherine was. She couldn't wait to escape into books, especially when she had to listen to her husband, Peter III, drone on about plans for a new palace or something. There's a scene in the book where one of their palaces burns to the ground and they have to relocate to this kind of squalid place, holes in the floor and rats running around. And the next morning, her servants bring her library to her, which they've saved from the burned palace. And she's just overjoyed and everything's okay with her again.
What'd she read?
Massey provides a running list of books that she read, everything from Tacitus to Montesquieu to Voltaire, and explains how they shaped her views on governing. But he also says she pretty much read anything at all. She'd even pick up whatever books her ladies-in-waiting left lying around. After Voltaire died, she bought his library for £135,000 and housed it in the Hermitage. But even before that, 15 years earlier, when Denis Diderot was hunting for money because he had spent years just compiling that encyclopedia for no pay, and now he had a daughter who—
Diderot was paid nothing to compile that huge encyclopedia?
He just took it on as a task of love, yeah. Talk about life of the mind. So he devoted himself to that. And now he had a daughter. She would need a dowry. So he put up his library for sale. It was his only asset of any value. He asked £15,000 for it. Catherine bought it for £16,000 with the stipulation that it had to stay with him. And she would pay him £1,000 a year to be her official librarian. Then the next year, she forgot to send him that money. And to make it up to him, she sent him £50,000 payment as an advance for the next 50 years.
So she must have been completely fluent in French recently.
Oh, she was. She, in fact, she was born in Germany. She was a minor German princess and was sent over to Russia. Peter's aunt, the Empress Elizabeth, had picked her as a princess to marry Peter.
So an arranged marriage, as they all did back
yeah,
then.
And she read in everything. French was really her favorite language. She read Russian. She taught herself Russian and read, you know, whatever Russian she could find. But she really loved to read French. And this was at the time of the Enlightenment. She really believed in a lot of the Enlightenment values until the French Revolution, when she suddenly feared for her own rule and turned her back on all of that.
Boy, it's fascinating. Okay, thanks a lot, Greg.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.